This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Parhiskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. مَثَلُ الَّذِينَ يُنْفِقُونَ أَمْوَالَهُمْ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سَبْعَ سَنَابِلَ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون
Good morning to all our listeners. You are tuned into Iran radio broadcast from Tehran. Here are some interesting facts about Islam. The Islamic world produced the first skilled, specially trained pharmacists who made their own medicines and worked closely with medical doctors and physicians. A 13th century Islamic writer...
Number of UN experts have condemned as extrajudicial execution U.S. military strikes on Venezuelan vessels in the Caribbean. welcome everybody. Our top story, the Israeli genocide in Gaza claims more civilian lives as the regime launches almost non-stop airstrikes on Gaza City. At least 12 Palestinians have lost their lives in Israeli attacks across Gaza since dawn. Seven of the victims were residents of Gaza City, where an Israeli airstrike earlier targeted the Sheikh Radwan neighborhood northwest of the city. Meanwhile, Israel has announced a temporary route for residents to flee the city as the regime launches a wide-scale ground offensive there. Elsewhere in Gaza, an Israeli airstrike on a house in the Nusayrat refugee camp killed a Palestinian man, his wife, and his daughter. The death toll from the U.S. Israeli genocide now exceeds 64,960, with more than 165,300 others injured. Hamas has rejected as lies Israel's allegations about using residential towers in Gaza City for military purposes. The movement said by raising such claims, the regime is trying to justify its fascist army's crimes and cover up systematic destruction of Gaza City. Hamas said Israel is doing to Gaza City what it had previously done to the cities of Rafah, Khan Yunis, Jabalia, Beit Hanun, and Beit Lahia. It also rejected the regime's accusations that Hamas uses civilians as human shields and prevents them from leaving Gaza City. Hamas said such claims prove the rogue entity's disregard for global public opinion and its insistence on continuing brutal massacres against innocent civilians in Gaza. The movement emphasized that Israel's lies and allegations will neither change the reality of this fascist entity and its terrorist army, nor will they conceal its sadistic thirst for the blood of innocent civilians and children. The United Nations Secretary General has expressed serious alarm about the situation in the Gaza Strip amid the Israeli genocide in the besieged territory. Speaking at a press briefing ahead of the annual meeting of the UN General Assembly, Antonio Guterres said, "What is happening in Gaza is horrendous." He called the war in the Palestinian territory morally, politically, and legally intolerable. Guterres noted that Israel is determined to go up to the end in its military aggression against Gaza and is not open to serious ceasefire talks. Let's hear more.
"It is not in the attributions of the Secretary General to do the legal determination of genocide. That belongs to the adequate judicial entities, namely the International Court of Justice. And let us be aware that at the present moment, the International Court of Justice is dealing with a case whose name is Application of the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide in the Gaza Strip. This is something we cannot forget. Independently of the names that are given, the truth is that this is something that it is morally, politically, and legally intolerable. With the attack that took place in Qatar, it doesn't look that Israel is interested in a serious negotiation for a ceasefire and the release of hostages. History will remember the 400 UN members that were killed in Gaza. History will remember all the efforts that we have made to denounce the constant violations of international law and, worst, the level of death and destruction that has no parallel in my time in office. History will remember that we have been in a leadership position in defense of the rights of the Palestinian people, in the promotion of a Palestinian state. That is what history will remember, not a question of semantics."
So we're going to go back to our top story as the Israeli genocide in Gaza claims more lives, and the regime has launched an almost nonstop assault on Gaza City. Our correspondent, Ghada Ibrahim, is joining us now from Deir al-Balah in central Gaza with more. Ghada, what do you have to share with us?
This morning, from 12 a.m. until now, at least 17 people were killed in different airstrikes across the Gaza Strip. And the focus point of the focus of the Israeli attacks is Gaza City itself. 10 of the casualties were killed in Gaza City. More people are still actually under the rubble of the destroyed buildings and the destroyed apartments and houses in the north of Gaza City. The Israeli occupation army keeps relentlessly targeting the most densely populated areas in the west of Gaza City. These areas, which most of the families and most of the people in the east and the north of Gaza were actually or sheltered in as a result of the continuous Israeli attacks, fleeing or escaping the death in the north and the east. However, nowadays, the Israeli occupation army, after launching its ground offensive and escalating the attacks, is stoking again the people who are now in the west of Gaza, terrorizing them and forcing them by fire and by the power of the air strikes in order to leave Gaza City or to evacuate the city. However, the situation in the west is really very catastrophic for these people. Many people are still buried under the rubble of the destroyed buildings and houses, as the civil defense crews are not able, with the minimum capabilities they have, or with their bare hands actually, without machinery, to extract those who are under the rubble of the destroyed houses, or to recover the bodies or the injured from under the rubble of these destroyed homes. And as we are talking about those who are fleeing from the north to the south of the city, this occupation army keeps also committing massacres in the south of the Gaza Strip, or in the middle area, as we mentioned before. The middle area witnessed in the past few days many massacres which actually highlights how the Israeli occupation army is promoting the existence of humanitarian zones or safe zones in the south, however, committing massacres in the same areas they are promoting as safe areas. This actually highlights how the Israeli occupation propaganda is working towards or is directed to the public or to the audience outside Gaza City. However, those in Gaza are actually know well that no place in Gaza is safe, and fleeing from the north to the south means like fleeing death and fleeing or escaping the death or the Israeli missiles and the Israeli attacks in the north towards another suffering or another kind of death in the south of the city. The situation in the middle area is really catastrophic. Only in the past 24 hours, at least 7 people were killed in Al-Nusayrat refugee camp, which is a densely populated area, which is also designated by the Israeli occupation army as a safe zone. And the Israeli occupation army has repeatedly ordered those in the north of Gaza to head towards Al-Nusayrat and Deir al-Balah and also Al-Mawasi area in the south of the strip. More people were also killed in another airstrike in Al-Mawasi area. 3 people in one airstrike were killed in Al-Mawasi area in the south of Gaza, of the Gaza Strip. Another massacre was also committed in the north of Gaza, in the densely populated area of An-Nafaq, and in the north of Gaza City.
All right, thanks a lot, Ghada Ibrahim, joining us from Deir al-Balah in central Gaza. Moving on, Spain's King Felipe has denounced the ongoing Israeli genocide in Gaza, saying it has led to unspeakable suffering for hundreds of thousands of Palestinians in a war-torn territory.
The latest episode in this conflict has claimed countless victims, degenerating into an unbearable humanitarian crisis, the unspeakable suffering of hundreds of thousands of innocent people, and the total devastation of Gaza.
The Spanish monarch made the remarks during a visit to Egypt, noting that his trip was taking place at a turbulent and tragic time for the region. He expressed Spain's support for reconciliation and stability in West Asia. A staunch critic of Tel Aviv's war on Gaza, Madrid has canceled a multi-million euro weapons contract with the Israeli firm Elbit System. The move followed Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez's pledge to turn into law a ban on all military sale or purchase deals with Israel over the regime's atrocities in Gaza. Last week, Spain recalled its ambassador to Israel amid heated exchanges after Sanchez's government announced measures aimed at stopping the genocide in Gaza. Thousands of people staged a rally in Rome in solidarity with the Gazans as the Israeli regime's military expands its ground offensive, forcing thousands to flee in Gaza City. They once again demanded Italy's government to stop supporting the genocide in the Strip.
On Tuesday, some 5,000 people took to the streets of the Italian capital, Rome, to hold a rally in solidarity with the besieged Palestinians in the aftermath of Israel's ground invasion of Gaza City. The initiative was called by a string of pro-Palestine groups, including the Palestinian Democratic Arab Union, the Palestinian Youth Movement, and the Italian-Palestinian Association. The rally was largely attended by high school and university students who chanted slogans such as "We are all anti-Zionists" and "Long live the Intifada."
No agli accordi.
We say no to any form of military, commercial and diplomatic engagement with a terrorist state which has been carrying out a genocide for 2 years, which has killed more than 20,000 children, over 60,000 people, and which has bombarded many West Asian countries. We must boycott terrorist Israel.
It's very refreshing, and it gives hope to see that the young people are starting to be aware of what's going around and to really express what they think. Because at the end of the day, it's the young, the new generation that is going to change the world.
People at the rally were bemused as to how Western countries haven't yet been able to impose sanctions on the Israeli regime after an endless list of war crimes committed in Gaza and in the West Bank since October 7, 2023. On Tuesday, even Italy's Deputy Prime Minister and Foreign Minister Antonio Tajani said that Rome was opposed to Israel's offensive to take control of Gaza City, a statement that arrives in the context of almost 2 years of unconditional support from Italy for the regime by providing weapons, military training and logistics.
Ha rappresentato una retorica di facciata.
It's Italy's usual rhetorical statements. There is no concrete actions put in place so that some real pressure is applied on Israel, with the goal to stop the occupation and the onslaught of Palestinians, which began long before October 7, 2023.
Two new large pro-Palestine demonstrations are slated to take place on September 22nd, when high school students will stage a nationwide day of strike against the Israeli regime's genocide in Gaza, and on October 4 in Rome. Max Civili, Rome.
Amid the mounting global rebuke against Israel, Canada has slammed its horrific the ground offensive in Gaza City. Canada's Ministry of Foreign Affairs said the offensive worsens the humanitarian crisis and puts in danger the release of Israeli captives held in Gaza. Ottawa also said Israel must comply with international law. Foreign Minister Anita Anand issued a separate message in support of Gaza. She said Canada, along with its international partners, demand a ceasefire in Gaza as well as immediate and permanent flow of humanitarian aid to the Palestinian territory. Ottawa earlier said it will vote in favor of the Palestinian statehood at a Security Council meeting on September 20th. Iran says the activation of the snapback mechanism by the JCPOA by the European Troika lacks any political and legal legitimacy. Abbas Araghchi added that the activation is a move in line with escalation and an increase in tensions. He made the remarks in a phone call with his French counterpart, Jean-Noël Barrot. The top Iranian diplomat also pointed to the recent agreement between Tehran and the International Atomic Energy Agency. Araghchi said the Islamic Republic considers diplomacy as the only way to resolve international issues, including Iran's nuclear program. In this regard, according to Araghchi, Iran is ready to find a balanced and fair solution that will guarantee mutual interests. Barrot, for his part, underlined the importance of dialogue and diplomacy. In late August, France, Germany, and the UK began the process of restoring major UN sanctions against Iran. The Islamic Republic has repeatedly said the E3 lacks the jurisdiction to reinstate those sanctions. United Nations human rights experts have sharply criticized the U.S. For military strikes on Venezuelan boats. They describe the attacks as extrajudicial executions. Three independent UN special rapporteurs stated that under international law, all countries must respect the right to life, even when operating on the high seas or in foreign territory. They added that the use of potentially illegal force is only permitted in personal self-defense or defense of what others against or defense of others against an imminent threat to life. In recent weeks, the U.S. military has struck a number of boats allegedly involved in drug trafficking originating from Venezuela. The attacks resulted in the death of at least 14 individuals. Meanwhile, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has called for national unity, framing the strikes as a looming threat of war in the Caribbean against his country.
The United States government, in violation of all international laws, treaties, international agreements, and the United Nations Charter, has subjected our country to a multifaceted war, and particularly in the last 5 weeks, to an absolutely reprehensible, criminal, and immoral threat. The matter at hand is a threat of war in the Caribbean against Venezuela. And the way for us to contain the threat, neutralize it, and defeat it completely so that peace may prevail is through the unity of all sectors of Venezuela, above political, ideological, color, culture, race, and religious differences. National unity, national unity, national unity.
Maduro's remarks came as he earlier called on his own party to be prepared to take up arms if the U.S. attacks the country. Tensions have been on the rise between Caracas and Washington after the U.S. significantly expanded its military presence near the South American nation. U.S. officials have cited their fight against drug trafficking as an excuse for the deployment. That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
Ocean of Dua.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على محمد وآله الطاهرين.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of the Ocean of Dua. And in this version of the program, we are trying to cover some of the names of the Almighty Allah that are recommended to be recited to invoke Him for obtaining benefits. So stay with us.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil farajahum wa al'an adahum ajma'in.
Dear listeners, Al-Muqaddim is another name of the Almighty Allah to be recited while we are trying to invoke Him. Al-Muqaddim means the vanguard. some kind of a forerunner. In contrast to this name is the name Al-Mu'akhir. Al-Muqaddim was related to the beginning, and Al-Mu'akhir is related to the last and ending. Al-Mu'akhir means the eternal last. The true servant believes that the Almighty Allah is the first and the last one to refer to. Another name of the Almighty Allah is Al-Muta'ali. Al-Muta'ali means the Most High. The Almighty Allah is in charge and in power, and He is capable of doing anything to us since we are His true servants. A mu'min, a believer, never stops his or her trying. Alongside having dua and supplication and invoking Allah, relying on Allah doesn't mean that we should stop whatever we are doing. In fact, on the contrary, it means that since we know that we rely on someone who is all-powerful and the Most High, He will help us in our affairs. But prior to that, we should do our best and do our duty and ask the Almighty Allah to help us complete and fulfill it.
Why do we make supplication? And why do we call out to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Is it because God is not aware of our needs? God is Al-Alim. He knows all of our needs. Is it because God needs convincing? God is known as Al-Jawad. He is the source of generosity. Then why am I making dua to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? The dua is a journey of realizations. When a person goes to the ocean and he takes with him a bucket that can carry 4 liters of water, the ocean is infinite. In as much as your vessel is large, that is the amount of water that the ocean will give you. And therefore, our goal is to expand our capacity. Rumi has a very beautiful poem. He says, Har khujo mushkil javab onjo ravad. Wherever there is a problem, that is where the answer will come. Har khujo keshti. Wherever there is a vessel, that's where the water will come. Don't go seeking for water. Instead, create the thirst within you. So that the water may burst forth from above and from below you. Experience that realization that you need God, and the mercy of God will come towards you.
The ocean of dua.
Among the names of the Almighty Allah to be recited while we are trying to invoke Him and ask Him for something, in order to gain more benefits, is this name, Ya Malik al-Mulk. So Malik al-Mulk is the absolute sovereign, and we call Him by this name since He is the only one who owns everything. And it is somehow like asking the Almighty Allah to give us whatever He knows that it's best. Since He is the Malik al-Mulk, He is the absolute sovereign, all-knowing and all-seeing. So the best kind of dua is the one that He thinks that's best for us, and that suits us the best. Another name of the Almighty Allah, which is closely related to this, is Al-Mughni. This name means the independent. By knowing and believing in this fact, that the Almighty Allah is the only one who is self-sufficient, the true meaning of self-sufficient is Him. He is the one who owns everything. He is the true and absolute sovereign. Then who would we refer to if we need anything? Another name is also Al-Mu'ti, which means the bestower of gifts. The Almighty Allah is self-sufficient, but also is the one whose favors are spread throughout the universe. He is the absolute Mu'ti. He is the total bestower of gifts. Dear brothers and sisters, among the names of the Almighty Allah to be recited while we're trying to invoke Him and ask Him for something is the name Al-Mani', which literally means the prohibitor. Repeating and reciting this name at a great deal is recommended. Al-Mannan, the benefactor. Since it means the benefactor, the reciting this name a great deal regularly will help us obtain divine favors and rewards. And it is exactly what we previously mentioned. The Almighty Allah is the absolute cause. He is the creator. He is the all-knowing and all-seeing. And all these epithets and nouns and names come in row just to prove one thing, that He is the absolute cause and He is the one that can be worshipped. So you can see the sense of monotheism in all these names of the Almighty Allah that are mentioned and will be mentioned. Of course, all the things we are mentioning in this program, dear listeners, have some different conditions to be met if we want to achieve the results. But whatever happens, reciting these names of the Almighty Allah will bring more the attraction of the Almighty Allah, and we can gain more benefits, especially while we are invoking Him and reciting dua.
Walhamdulillahi ala afwihi ba'da qudratih, walhamdulillahi ala tuli anatihi fi ghadabih, وهو قادر على ما يريد الحمد لله خالق الخلق باسط الرزق فالق الأصباح ذي الجلال والإكرام والفضل والإنعام الذي بعد فلا يرى وقرب فشهد النجوى.
And the last name, dear listeners, that will be mentioned in this program to be recited in the beginning of our du'as or while we're invoking Him and calling on to Him is the name Al-Muntaqim. Al-Muntaqim literally means the avenger, the one who avenges and gets revenge for someone or something else. If somebody's rights have been taken away from him or her, the true Muntaqim is the Almighty Allah, the All-Powerful, the Most High, and the Avenger, since He is the one who is punishing those people in Hereafter and Resurrection Day. Anyway, the name Muntaqim, the Avenger, can be recited many times regularly, and the enemies will never be able to harm us again. Dear listeners, we ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Hello and welcome to Attrition. I'm your host, Amar Kazmi. In this show, we delve into the forces of war, imperialism, and Zionism, exploring their impact on our world and what it will take to overcome them. I'm delighted to be joined today by investigative journalist and author Matt Kennard. Matt is the co-author of Silent Coup, How Corporations Overthrew Democracy, and the author of two other acclaimed books. He used to be a staff writer at the Financial Times in New York, Washington, D.C., and London. He then served as a fellow and later director of the Center for Investigative Journalism in London, and he co-founded Declassified UK. He is now an independent journalist. Thank you very much for joining me today, Matt.
Good to be with you, Amar.
I want to go straight into talking with you about Britain's active involvement, not just complicity, in the genocide that's being perpetrated in Gaza. In January 2024, you broke a story about how Britain had conducted 50 spy flights over Gaza in support of Israel. That number is now over 500. And you've continued to cover that issue, which until recently was totally not just ignored, but I would say covered up by the mainstream media. Before we get into how and why that mission has come to an end, could you give us a recap about what these spy flights are and what they were all about?
Yeah, well, as you say, these spy flights are the key component of UK support for Israel's genocide, which makes it active participation rather than complicity because, and this is not just me saying this is legal experts, if you are providing intelligence from over a territory being attacked by a genocidal power, you are a party to that conflict, and you're giving intelligence, which to this day we still don't know what that intelligence is, and we don't know what departments of the Israeli state they're providing it to. But these flights were announced in December 2023 by the Tory administration at that point. And it was just a government press release, and they did not say where they were going from, how long they were going to be in the sky, what plane would be used, or anything about it. And so I started looking on flight tracking websites and found where the plane was going from, which was RAF at Criterion, Cyprus, which I'd been working on up to that point anyway, because that's the key international site for all the international support for Israel in terms of arms supplies, spies being sent, logistics support since the genocide started and continues now. But anyway, so I started seeing these flights go, saw that they were Shadow R1 planes, which are intelligence, reconnaissance, and surveillance planes, which can really get granular detail on the ground. And one of their main capabilities is target acquisition for military strikes. I saw they were going every day as well, and they've basically gone every day up till about a week ago. And they're in the sky for 6 hours. One of those hours is getting to and from Gaza from RAF at Criterion, Cyprus. 5 hours over Gaza, just collecting intelligence. Now, we never knew what their flight path was over Gaza, because what happened was about halfway to Gaza, they turned the transponder off. Then on the way back, they turned the transponder back on. So there's massive amounts of secrecy around it, and also not just around the flights themselves, but around what intelligence is being collected and how it's being used by Israel. Because when they've had to defend it, the government, which is very little, because as you say, the mainstream media barely covered it. In fact, they haven't covered it at all, really. But when they've had to defend it, when they've been asked questions in Parliament by MPs, who have, some of them have been quite dogged, all they say is, well, it's all to do with hostage rescue. And we only give intelligence to the relevant authorities. They never say what those relevant authorities are. But think about it. That's semantic wordplay. Israel characterizes their whole genocide as a hostage rescue operation. The relevant authorities for hostage rescue must be the occupation forces and their intelligence agencies, because they're the one leading the campaign. So I think we need much more will come out over the coming years. And hopefully, and this is why I believe that the ICC and the ICJ need to get involved, because the process of legal discovery would mean that we could get a lot of information that we can't as journalists, because we're talking about institutions and agencies within the UK state, which are the most secret parts of the UK state, the intelligence agencies. And they're not secret to defend us. Maybe there's a little bit of secrecy they need for their operations, but 95% of it is to defend themselves from us. All this stuff has been got from open source. There's been no actual whistleblower from within the program. So if you started scratching the surface, I'm sure it would completely unravel, and you'd find out that we have been for nearly 2 years just active participants in a very direct way. So it's hugely important. I mean, this is, and it goes to what you were saying about the media. I sometimes can't understand how it's just, and a few other journalists, but it's basically been me covering this story. There's no more serious crime than genocide that a state can commit. And when you're talking about our government actively participating in it, this should be like every journalist in the country that's covering this stuff should be going any avenue they can to get the information, and there's been nothing. And I think it goes to the heart of what the media in this country is for. We don't have a media in the sense of how it's commonly understood. What we have is a propaganda system, and Gaza has exposed that, I think, like never before. Gaza has exposed many, many different myths that we live by in this country and globally. But one of the biggest ones is that we have this crusading free press, fourth estate, which holds power to account. We don't at all. It operates 99% of the time as a arm of the state itself. And the other 1%, when they're actually doing critical stories, they're always surface scandals. They're nothing that tells you anything about the systematic workings of the British state. And definitely don't tell you anything about the secretive agencies, which have a lot of power in this country and are basically never covered. So... it's been a pretty eye-opening experience covering this stuff. And also, the other thing which I should mention is Spyfire is only one component. And there's obviously the arms that have been going. 150,000 bullets were sent to Israel soon after October 7th when the genocide started. They've been sending armored tanks, all sorts of different military equipment. They also have sent parts for the F-35 plane, which became controversial recently because they, when Labour announced a partial suspension of arms to Israel in September 2024, they carved out the parts for the F-35 jet, which 15% of which is produced in the UK, which is absurd, because how can you say, well, our lawyers have said that any weapons that go to Israel that can be used in Gaza run the risk of being used in violations of international humanitarian law, and leave out the part, which is the parts for the main bit of technology which is carrying out that genocide. It doesn't make any sense on the legal terms. And in fact, there was a recent case which was lost insanely by two human rights groups to try and get the government to stop the F-35 parts anyway. Then there's also the SAS, which again is not talked about at all. In fact, there was the only mention of the SAS in Gaza was in the mainstream media on October 27th. There was an article in The Sun, and this is how the SAS worked. They're not against leaks, but they only do official leaks, and always there to present the SAS as this heroic institution. So in October 27th, 2023, there was an article in The Sun, which was based on sources saying that the SAS had deployed to Cyprus for Gaza operations, heroic hostage rescue operations. Following day, a D-notice was sent out by the Ministry of Defence to all media to say you can't publish anything more about UK special forces in Gaza. To this day, there's not been a single bit of information which has come out in the media about what those special forces have been doing. I actually recently published that D-notice because I got hold of it. Again, it goes back to the media point. I mean, and means they're complicit. If they have information, have received information about our special forces being involved in Israel or on the ground in Gaza, it's not preposterous to think that could have happened. And they've not published it because they've been told by the Ministry of Defence that there's a D-notice. They're complicit because the D-notice is officially voluntary. So there's not even any punitive... I mean, there might be sort of like unofficial punitive measures that can be taken against newspapers. But the fact that we've had no more information, the fact that they kept that D-notice secret, the D-notice I published for the first time had gone to every single media editor in the UK. And not one thought it would be the right moral thing to publicise it. The only way we knew about its existence was a socialist worker wrote a story about it. They didn't publish the D-notice itself. But that was a big service in itself. But so it's deep, deep complicity. I don't think you can think of the Gaza genocide as just an Israeli genocide. It's and I say this all the time, so I'm sure people are bored of hearing it, but it is a tripartite genocide. It's the US, it's the UK, and it's Israel. Now, the US providing the vast majority of the arms, also special forces, by the way. It was reported early in the genocide that US special forces had been deployed to Israel. Britain providing the majority of the intelligence, it seems, or that's their role, and Israel getting it done because, and I'll finish with this, just on the spy flights where we started, subsequent to the work we were doing, there was an investigation by Al Jazeera into reconnaissance flights over Gaza. This came out last year, 2024, and they found that 47% of all reconnaissance flights over Gaza were flown by the RAF, which was more than double Israel itself. So how are you not a party to a conflict if that's the stats that have been gathered from open source intelligence? That and the UK government admits they're giving that intelligence to Israel. They don't say what departments or what it's for, what apart from hostage rescue. But to me, there's no confusion. If we lived in a world which actually applied international law, UK ministers would be getting arrest warrants from the ICC now. And again, I should we talk a lot about Starmer and Lamy and John Healey, who's the defense secretary, but this also goes for the previous Conservative administration who started the spy flights themselves. So Rishi Sunak, Grant Shapps, who was defense secretary, David Cameron, who was foreign secretary. So there's a whole coterie of war criminals that have served in the UK government and been complicit in, and participants, in fact, in one of the worst crimes in modern history, maybe of all history. So it's going to take years of work to unravel the reality of what's happening, because as I say, what we know now is the result of independent journalists using mostly open source stuff. So as soon as over the years, when we get more whistleblowers, when we get more information, hopefully from legal cases and other avenues, we'll get a much more full understanding. And that's why I always say, like, this won't stop when the genocide finishes. This is a years of work that we're all going to be dedicated to, because we have to hold the people that are accountable for this to justice, because if we don't, then we just accept that we live in a genocidal world and the law of the jungle rules, and we can't accept that. So it's imperative to stop it happening again, but also just to stop the complete disintegration of our society, that we hold accountable the people that did this. And obviously, we have some hope in the ICC arrest warrants for Netanyahu and Gallant, because although they took too long, that's the first time Western leaders have been, and our allies have been prosecuted, despite us being the most violent and war criminal countries in the world. So the fact that that threshold was crossed means that the idea that our own prime minister or the US president, or it would be hard for the US president because they're not part of the SEC, but, you know, the people that we assume, and people would be shocked if you said they're going to be in the restaurant. We need to change that idea, and we need to understand that the ICC was essentially created as an imperial tool, and it was created to go after official enemies, which is what it did up to the Gaza genocide.
I agree completely on that, and of course we praise you for the work that you've done in exposing all of this. I think because of your doggedness in pursuing the government on these sorts of matters, you were even blacklisted at one point by the UK Ministry of Defence.
Yeah, that was earlier on at Declassified. That was actually a very salutary tale of how the media system worked. That happened like about a year into us founding Declassified. And I did a story basically about how MI5 and MI6 were training spies from some of the worst dictatorships in the world, like the Saudis, the Egyptians, the UAE, at a base called Chicksands just outside London. And like always, I contacted the MOD for comment, because it was an MOD course that they were training them on, and they just didn't respond. And then I called them and they said, "We'll get back to you," and they didn't respond. So I was very they never do this, this is the first time this has happened. And then a couple of weeks later, there was a protest by Ahmed Al-Batati. I don't know if you remember him.
Yes.
He was a Yemeni British soldier, but a British Yemeni, who was serving in the Ministry of Defence and went out in his fatigues outside the Ministry of Defence and blew a whistle, every minute to symbolize how many Yemenis were dying because of the British war in Yemen, which it was a British war. It wasn't just a Saudi war. He got arrested by military police and then discharged. But anyway, when he was taken in, Phil Miller, my colleague, contacted the Ministry of Defense for comment about what had happened to him, what the process was, and they didn't get back to him. And then he called them again, and he was recording the call, and the officer and the press officer said, "Oh, we don't deal with your publication anymore," which is a contravention of the civil service code, by the way, because you're meant to, you have to interact with all journalists despite their political affiliations or style of journalism. And then they probably thought, well, this is a small website, nothing's going to happen. But it escalated, and a Council of Europe media alert was sent out, level two, which is quite a big deal, and also means, because the Council of Europe, the UK is part of, meant that the Ministry of Defence had to respond. So anyway, Ben Wallace, who was then Defence Secretary, ordered a inquiry, which was carried out by Tony Blair's former spokesperson, not Alistair Campbell, another one. And he published a report which showed essentially that we'd been blacklisted, but yet Ben Wallace still didn't accept that there was a blacklisting in his place. He said it appeared to many people in the press office that it was a blacklisting. It was just like legalese. But the interesting thing was he that whole report, which was quite shocking, by the way, it was like anonymous military officers said, we need to put them on a list of hostile media organizations. You don't know what that means within the context. So they published that report, which was a long report, very, very shocking and worrying for the free press. Then Wallace gets up in the House of Commons, apologizes to Declassified UK, which is kind of unprecedented, and still to this day, not a single word about it has ever appeared in the mainstream media, which is crazy. Because when you talk about that level of response, like you would imagine, and the Council of Europe, you expect that the mainstream media, who you would think would defend fellow journalists who are actually doing proper work, unlike them, they didn't. But that was, again, it goes to show that the Ministry of Defence just did not know how to deal with journalists who, I mean, and they still are, don't take any state or corporate funding, completely independent, not working for any hostile powers or anything. But they just couldn't accept journalists, or didn't understand journalists that were asking questions in a critical way to try and find out information that the government didn't want out. Like, literally, if you look at the main defence correspondents from, like, Jonathan Beale at the BBC, Deborah Haynes at Sky News, nearly everything they publish is just a reworded MOD press release. It's shocking. Well,
Jonathan Beale recently decried the reporting on these spy flights. I think he attacked Des Friedman and also maybe John McAvoy at Declassified for reporting on it. And he asked, I'm paraphrasing, whether they had access to some secretive, privileged information. And it's like, well, this is all publicly sourced. If you're doing your job, you'd have also discovered this.
It's a mindset. That's the interesting thing. That's my take on a propaganda system. It's not that he is being controlled. It's just that he has not ever got in his head an idea that he wants to find out information that the government doesn't want out. Because he's so immersed in that mainstream media world, especially at the BBC, where you're just an appendage of the state, that the thought to actually maybe do a bit of independent research never crosses his mind. It's that Noam Chomsky interview with Andrew Marr, you know, when Andrew Marr says, do you believe I don't think what I say? And he said, no, you think what you say, but you wouldn't be where you are if you thought any different. So anyone who does critical journalism gets filtered out way before they get to the level of Jonathan Beale. And that's the way it works. And that's why it's quite funny when they respond like that, because they're not aware of it. They always say, well, I can write what I want, and I can do what I want. It's like, well, that's because you never say anything that the state doesn't like. If you did, you'd soon find out that they wouldn't allow you to continue. But but as you say, I mean, you say they're active participants. I'd say they're complicit, definitely, because if you, like, to go back to the F-35 September 2020 2024 suspensions by Labour, right, that only happened because when the media has focused on UK role, it's always on arms, which is good. Like, obviously, I think there should be a complete arms embargo. There should have been one a long time ago. But the government was pressured by that media pressure and mainstream media pressure. If that mainstream media had borne that pressure on the spy flights, they would have been grounded a year ago or more.
Also, just speaking of complicity, you recently broke a story that numerous Israeli jets have been active in perpetrating the Gaza genocide have been landing in Britain.
Yeah, mad. Not picked up at all by the mainstream media as it never is. But yeah, that's is active participation, because these are Israeli tankers. They're called Reem air-to-air refueling planes. Yeah, they landed at Bryce Norton 9 times at least. That's what we could find. I'm sure there's more. But they landed at RF Bryce Norton, all under the Labour government. And then days later, on some occasions, they were flying off Gaza, refueling fighter jets, when there were massacres of nearly 100 people in one in Beit Lahia. And it just got. And then recently, the head of the Israeli Air Force came and attended the air tattoo at a UK military base. This is a guy that is basically the architect of, in terms of the air war, of the genocide. And he's been welcomed by the Labour government. It is astounding, the level of complicity and participation. And it goes to the fact that I think that effectively we are occupied by the Israeli state in many ways through different mechanisms. One is the official Israel lobby, like the Israeli embassy and its various different agencies, but also through the groups they have within our political system, like Labour Friends of Israel, Conservative Friends of Israel, which are front groups for the embassy, both of whom don't reveal their funders. But you know, in that Al Jazeera documentary, the lobby, Michael Rubin, who was then the parliamentary officer for the LFI, was recorded outside a pub saying, well, we work closely with the embassy and they send us things to say when there's trouble for Israel. So effectively, every statement you see posted by LFI is probably drafted by the Israeli embassy, highly likely. That's one section. Then there's the other section, which is nominally Jewish groups that are meant to represent Jewish interests or Jewish communal interests that have been infiltrated by the Israeli embassy and the Zionist movement and made to work, like the Jewish labor movement. There's not hard evidence of links to the embassy, although Ella Rose was at the Israeli embassy and then became head of Jewish labor movement, I think. But it's clear from their statements that they're basically operating as an Israel lobby group. The same with the...
Well, I mean, even in the Jewish labor movement constitution, they're bound to support Israel.
Exactly, yeah. And the Board of Deputies of British Jews, right, which is, again, presents itself as a Jewish communal group representing the community in Britain, it's explicitly a Israel lobby group, because if you look at the parliamentary records of ministers' meetings, they say the Board of Deputies is coming in, and what do they say they're talking about? Israel-Palestine, and they're arguing the case for Israel. It's see-through. So you've got that element as well. And then you've got the media that is and that these organizations play a role, but the other way that we're occupied is there's various mechanisms that can be used to stop the ascent of a leader who might take decisions which are to the detriment of Israel, which we saw very clearly with Jeremy Corbyn. And he gets criticized for not being radical enough on his Israel policy, which, fair enough, I agree with that. But in both manifestos, he said there would be an arms embargo on Israel in terms of weapons that could be used in human rights violations against Palestinians. Like, that was completely unprecedented. I don't think it ever appeared in the mainstream. And how was he destroyed? One of the main mechanisms was that the bogus anti-Semitism campaign, which began as soon as he was elected leader.
Before that, actually.
Huh? Well, before that. And actually, Ed Miliband, who was the leader before Corbyn, he also came under, because he wanted to recognize Palestine. People forget this whole episode. And there was a whole fake anti-Semitism thing around him as well. So there's various mechanisms, which mean it's very, very hard, in fact, maybe impossible, for the British state and its different agencies, like the military, to put a hand up and say no to Israel. And that's just the proof's in the pudding. If we're inviting a guy who's the head of the Air Force, when his boss, the Prime Minister, has an ICC arrest warrant out to the UK to talk for meetings, that something's wrong. If we're allowing the Israeli planes that are involved in the bombing of Gaza, which has been orchestrated by a Prime Minister who's got an ICC arrest warrant out, how that doesn't make sense in any way, unless to say that the British state is not acting in its own interest or in our interest. It goes, I mean, there's another example I've looked into, which is the prescription thing, right? Prescription of Palestine Action was pushed by the Israel lobby. Prescription of Hezbollah was pushed by the Israel lobby. Both those things, I think, if even the British establishment had control over the things, wouldn't have done. One, because Palestinian is so preposterous, it's just it's become unworkable and it is an embarrassment now. On the Hezbollah thing, they got two ministers in the Lebanese government. They don't. The British government don't want to, in terms of British national interest, they don't want to alienate and make it impossible to negotiate, to deal with people in positions of power
Well, this is why I think, you know, Britain has lost a lot of its diplomatic capital around the world, particularly through this prescription regime, which is why global diplomacy now doesn't happen out of London. It happens out of Doha in Qatar.
Good day to all of our listeners. This is Iran Radio. And here are some interesting facts about Islam. During the Middle Ages, the Muslim world had two numerous business advantages. They had a huge range of contacts, so they could trade everything from African gold to Chinese porcelain to European amber and furs. And Muslim craft workers were highly skilled, which meant their goods always found a real market. Without Muslim merchants, Europeans would have had no rice, sugar, or coffee. Approximately 5 to 8 million Muslims lived in the United States, and there are over 1,200 mosques. Muslims have been a part of the cultural landscape in America for the past 200 years. The Islamic Empire once stretched into modern-day Europe, particularly in Spain and the Balkans. Today, there are tens of millions of Muslims living in Europe. Now we'll listen to the continuation of our schedule on Iran Radio. We start off this hour's programs with our varied radio productions feature. Then it's time for Insights into the Holy Quran. The program presents a short exegesis or explanation of the ayahs of the Holy Quran. Our radio productions feature will again follow after this. And we round up this hour's programs with Ulama's speech. Stay with us for this hour.
winding and beautiful road, we're heading towards the city of Tuysurkan, that's enclosed by green and picturesque valleys. A city that was built atop the ruins of an old town destroyed during the Mongol invasion of Eurasia. Tuysurkan is in the province of Hamedan in western Iran, about 5 or 6 hours' drive from Tehran. The weather at our destination is mild and pleasant for this time of year, but since the city is surrounded by the Zagros Mountains, it can become very cold at night and at winter times. Because of its vast walnut orchard, Tuysurkan is known as the hub of Persian walnut. But that aside, all the things I'm going to show you will point to the rich historical background and culture of this city.
One of the mansions that has stood the passage of time since the Qajar period is this two-story building, the Masudi House, named after the actual residence. And it's now a museum. Come on, let's go inside.
The most eye-catching thing in the entire house is the chamber on the first floor where guests were entertained. The entire ceiling and walls of this room are covered with stucco, mirror work, paintings and motifs depicting the kings of old Persia,